Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 274. How do you prepare your Python data science projects for production? What are the essential tools and techniques to make your code reproducible, organized, and testable? This week on the show, Quinn Tran from CodeCut discusses her new book, Production Ready Data Science. Quinn shares how she got into blogging and what motivated her to write a book. She shares tips on how to create repeatable workflows, and we delve into modern Python tools that'll help you bring your projects to production. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Quinn, welcome to the show.
Hi, Christopher. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, I was excited when your team reached out to have you come on the show. I just featured one of your articles on our other type of show called PyCoders, the top six Python libraries for visualizations. I really like how you put that together.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you do a good job of providing not just a set of features in comparison, but like a way for people to get an idea of how it might fit into the different ways that they work, because there are so many different approaches to data science.
Yeah. When I write articles, I imagine my audience are data scientists who are, you know, very busy to like write an article, and they want to scan the articles, have an idea of what the tool does and what are the use cases. So every article, I try to keep that in mind.
Yeah. I really appreciate it. I think your audience probably appreciates it too. So how long have you been blogging and doing the website now?
I have been blogging for quite a while. I doing it when I was in college, actually. So 5-6 years.
Okay, great.
Yeah. And so it's not necessary. So initially I write a lot of Medium and I grow like a big followers on Medium. I think at the time I write and I try to commit to writing around like at least one article per week, and it's always end up like 3 articles per week. Like I wake up, I do something and then I write. Any free time I have, I write. And I guess it's like a fun thing for me, but it's also like a commitment. But at the time, I try to write to like, you know, build my portfolio. But then like after I have a job and everything, it's still like a passion of mine to share my knowledge.
Yeah.
So I've been doing it continuously since then. But later, I decided to create my own website to, you know, send out newsletter and stuff to like just kind of have more control over.
Yes.
You know, what I send out, because you know how it's, I really don't like Medium. It have like a whole paywall. And
yeah.
To me, I like to be open to everybody to read.
Yeah, as a person who shares a lot of those links, it always is a little awkward. Like, are they going to be able to get through that wall to be able to see the stuff that I'm talking about that I'm sort of summarizing it? Yeah, it's a little frustrating that way. So yeah, that's good. That sounds great. And your site is codecut.ai. I'll share links in the show notes, obviously.
Thank you.
One of the things I wanted to talk about is you've kind of decided to grow into writing a whole book, and you've written a book, Production Ready Data Science. Tell us about it. What's in the book?
Yeah, so it's a kind of like a handbook for data scientists who want to learn how to turn in their prototyping into code that is ready for production. And it's not a book about, you know, how to containerize your machine learning models or how to deploy it to cloud, but it's more about it. This comes from my experience. So I was a data scientist in a startup. So it was a very small data science team. So my responsibility, I do a lot end to end, creating model, analyze the data, and then also ship it, give it to machine learning engineer, right?
Yeah.
And I saw the pen of machine learning engineer. So my manager, he's a very good data scientist, but he's not very good at coding. So a lot of time the machine learning engineer need to like rewrite a lot of his code. So I want to like, you know, how do I write the code in a way that when I give it to him, he can immediately like just minimal edit and then use it for production. That's one thing. Another thing I found is it's a pain for me to, you know, write a lot of code in a notebook and then later try to understand what I wrote.
Sure.
And also, you know, if I run my notebook in different orders, then it will show different outputs. So it's very messy. At the same time, it's not reusable. It's really hard for me to reuse it for a different project that use similar pieces of code. Like how do I extract it out so that I can reuse different components? And another thing that go with it is, you know, unit testing, right? How do I make sure that this code works for different circumstances? So the book is about kind of good Python practices, you can say, for data scientists, including writing Python variables, Python classes, Python functions. Like, when should you even use Python classes? Because sometimes, you know, you don't know. It's not really necessary for a data science project. Also, unit testing. Also, like, hard coding, right? Like, a lot of time, like, in Python projects, in a data science project, you see a lot of global variables being used, hard-coded variables. And I offer the alternative, which is using a configuration. So you have a configuration file where you put all the values so you can very easily change it, right? But at the same time, you have all your code logic in a different place so that it looks very clean. And also you can unit test independent of the hard-coded values.
Yeah. That's huge. There's so many topics inside there that we could dive deep into.
Yeah.
Maybe I start in reverse. I feel that's a common thing with notebooks generally, is they aren't very reusable in kind of a strange way. I've reported multiple times on the show about this Jupyter notebook study that JetBrains did, where they worked with another team to look at, you know, hundreds of notebooks out there and try to run them from top to bottom, and they just wouldn't run. Yeah. And it's just
that's funny.
Yeah, it's just so weird. It's just like the idea is you are using it almost like a, not necessarily a student, but just as a notebook, as a researcher, and somebody taking your notebook and, you know, say they stole it from you and ran off, and they're going through your written notebook. Would they be able to put together your experiment anyway? And it feels that way, you know.
Yeah.
And so I definitely want to dive into that. I like the importing idea. That's something that I've seen happening more often, where are you doing that from another notebook file or from a standard package like Python file?
Yeah, I like that idea. I think, you know, there's not like the right or wrong way, right?
Sure.
The thing that notebook does very well is that it is interactive and you can see the output as well as you can like, you know, turn it into like a nice report, right? With all the graph. That cannot be done very easily with Python script. So I think it's not about like niching the notebook, but like know when to use it for.
Yeah.
I do think that it's very, like, for example, you can start with a notebook, but then, like, if you start seeing, like, yourself using, like, creating Python classes and use it for different cells, maybe it's time for you to move it to, like, a Python script and just import it in, and it looks very clean, right? Imagine you do, like, I don't know, some sort of processing function that you keep finding yourself reuse, then I feel like it's very clean just to import it and use it, as long as you keep the Python function name readable as well.
Yeah. I agree that the modularizing of your code is something that's, I think, this computer science-y kind of education part that is sort of stressed early, of compartmentalizing your code and breaking it down and making it reproducible but also reusable. And so, yeah, I agree with that. I think that's really fantastic. And then, like you said, it leads to testing. One thing that I feel like you're doing it throughout the book that sounds really interesting is almost building what I'm getting back into creating a bunch of music. I kind of dropped out for a while. That's why I have all the guitars and stuff behind me, because I wanted to always inspire myself whenever I would look at the camera and go, I should be playing guitar now. But I use a lot of software, and sometimes it's painful to start with all the technology that's available now. And often it's nice to be able to have a template, to have like, okay, I want to do this type of music today. And in your particular case, you could do that with a notebook. You could have, okay, these are the types of libraries that I like to use. I know that I'm going to want to have a dashboard or something like that. Is that something similar to what you're talking about? Like being able to create a reusable, if you will, partially filled out notebook page that you're kind of filling in the blanks on to get projects started?
That sounds interesting. I haven't tried that before, using a notebook as a template.
Okay.
But can you tell me more about it, actually, like about the idea?
I think what you could do is have, maybe with this new edition of lazy imports, we could look at it too, where, you know, you're not necessarily going to import them until you start using them. Again, this is a Python 3.14 further thing.
Yeah.
You could, depending on the type of project, have a certain, you know, not only the libraries that you might use, but you could have some initial code that sets up like the dashboard the way that you like to usually use it. Maybe there's styling that you have that has been templated. That's something that I always liked about Matplotlib, because it is kind of painful to get Matplotlib to look attractive.
Yeah.
And the tools are there, but you just need to know about them and be able to bring them in. I don't know. I'm just sort of bouncing it off of you, I guess. I didn't know if that was kind of some of the ideas that might be part of the book.
Yeah, that is interesting. I did talk about a template, but so I created a template for the book, but it's not necessary on notebook, focus on notebook, but it's more about the entire project structure.
Okay.
So because in my opinion, there's different ways for you to structure a data science project.
Yes.
But there should be a standard, meaning that the source code often put in the SRC folder, the notebooks should probably put in like notebooks folder, the test should put in the test folder with like, you know, similar like test processing function, and in the source you will have processing function, and there will be a config folder with all the config files. And also another thing, I guess it's similar to what you said about some of the stuff, if you keep reusing it, and it would be nice if you spin it up and then like you have all of it in one place. Another thing that I found very redundant when I create a new project is PryProject.com. So I like to use, right now I'm using UV and Ruff.
Yeah.
Right. And I like to configure it in, and for people who know where UV is, kind of same alternative to Poetry and Pip. And Ruff is a Python formatter.
Yeah, linter, formatter, all in one kind of toy.
All in one toy. Yeah, and I like to like ignore some rules. So like you can set some ignoring rules and like, you know, like how many lines, how many words in a line. So those things I like to keep it constant, like, because that's not my preference. But every time copy and paste that, and among everything else, including the structure, is quite a bit of work. So I created a template that you can just say cookie cutter and then the name of the...
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask, if you're using that tool.
Yeah, and then boom, you have everything. And it's going to ask you some initial question like, okay, which Python version are you using? What's your name? You know, just for the project, if we decide to package in the package, like some basic stuff, and then it customize, and you have something to start off with instead of like just an empty project.
Yeah, cookie cutter is, I feel like it comes from the web development community, and the idea of building sites, they usually reuse a lot of elements, and doing things like you talked about of building a directory structure and having it be consistent. UV does that too, to a point, which is also nice. Mm-hmm. You know, building the initial TAML file and a lot of these reproducible things. So it's nice to see the tooling kind of, levels up and becoming more standardized. Definitely in the 5 years that I've been working more and more, or even doing the show, I've liked how this has moved forward and become more standardized. But the trick is just finding the best navigational path, because often it's a problem of there's so much overhead to just begin doing work.
Yeah, and there shouldn't be.
And so, yeah, anything to help people start that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe we could talk about that a little bit. You mentioned in there a few things about reproducibility, and you are saying that a lot of the data scientists that you were working with, some of the team leads, you would try to share, I guess, within the team, say a project that's, you know, living in a notebook. What were some of the struggles of that other person trying to reproduce it? What was standing in their way?
I guess it's more of the struggle is both. So I think what I mentioned earlier was more of a struggle between giving the notebook to a machine learning engineer.
Okay.
I guess it's a reproducible was a problem. Like if a data scientist give me a notebook, and like oftentimes there are problems when it comes to dependencies management, and it's different problem can go with notebook, but I guess like, and that I don't think is specific to notebook, but I would just say like dependencies in general, like oftentimes data scientists also like to use Conda. And yes. I'm not a fan of Conda really, but I would install, so data scientists, let's say they was using a Microsoft, right? Another person using a Windows. I'm using a Mac.
Sure.
So okay. I try to, you know, Conda install from a dependency management file. Then what happened is, yeah, I installed successfully, but like there would be like some packages, like some system packages that require some installation differently on Mac, I think. Mm. And then like I couldn't run it. So it's a lot of troubleshooting that comes with dependencies. And so that's okay because it raised an error. But what I think is more dangerous is a silent error, like when it doesn't raise an error, but because of the dependencies differences, you know, then like it will produce different output. Let's say I'm trying to think of example. For example, pandas. I would just throw it out there. But let's say in the older version, it doesn't require you to. Let's say the default of the old pandas data frame for a specific value is A, and then in the new version is B. So because you don't specify that default value. So when you go to a new dependencies, it show like a different output, but it's not necessary. So you don't know because it doesn't throw any error, but then like you see a performance degrade and you don't know why.
Yeah.
So that would be like one of the thing I think is a problem.
Yeah, yeah. UV is the tool that you're using of choice now.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't think about the barrier of moving across the different sort of computer platform. Like if you're again on Mac and Linux, your environments are a little more similar. A lot of the packaging of the tools that we use, especially across Python, are similar, but I could see how the Conda stuff could be a little different in that sense. Is that kind of where that was breaking down? Like there's like a Windows version of the way it was sort of prepared in Conda. Has UV solved that for you?
I think so. Yeah, I think it has been solved very reliably because I say I think so because for all the projects I've been working on, it's good, but I didn't go back to my previous project and try to use it for that.
Right.
But I really like UV because of the fact that it have two files. One is a log files that, you know, that log the dependencies,
right?
Which is like if you wanted to reproduce the exact dependencies, you can do it. But at the same time, it had the PyProject.tom with more flexible dependencies. So yeah, that's become that's why I really enjoy UV. It's also very fast.
Yeah, yeah. The log files would solve that, say potentially pandas issue you were mentioning before.
Yeah,
yeah. Now you know you're gonna get the exact version.
Yeah,
there, which is good.
Yeah, and also I would say now the problem, and I wrote it in the book, but like with PEEP, right? like compare UV with pip, for example. A lot of time, you know, when you run pip install something, and then like there's a dependency issue, but it's installed anyway. The dependency conflict, that is not like something to be ignored. And if that like there could be like potential downstream issues that come with like different that you don't match dependencies that the package require.
Yeah.
But with UV, like if that happens, it's gonna stop you, right? So you can try to find a way to match the dependencies of the packages that use together.
You feel like it presents you with information that you can kind of work off of.
What with yeah.
compared to pip.
Yes.
In that sense. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things you mentioned, again, kind of going back to the data frame area, is that you're liking to use, you're using Polars outside of Pandas. What are some of the reasons that you've decided to do it? I know one of the ones right away is that it's much faster, but are there other advantages you've seen with switching to Polars?
Yeah, I also like the syntax. Like I feel it's more expressive compared to, like you can do a lot of chain.
Yes.
With Polars. I also like, yeah, I like the syntax. It's very expressive. Like you can say polar doc, something, something. It's similar to PySpark, in my opinion.
Okay.
And another thing is lazy execution. I think it's very cool that I think it's very efficient in the way that, you know, like it doesn't make sense for you to, let's say, load in 1 million rows, and then you only use 1,000, or you the same with columns. So you use only 5 columns, but you import 100 columns. So it's very yeah. inefficient. And the fact that there's something that like that just load what is necessary, or like process what that you request for, I really like that about Polars.
Yeah, yeah. That's something I've had a few people on to talk about, and it definitely seems to be one of the biggest benefits is just the idea that you as a data scientist, let's say, you know, a generalized you person, mm-hmm. don't have, you know, maybe you're working on a laptop and it has a limited amount of RAM and you still want to do data exploration and you want to try things out. The lazy execution lets you really do a lot of it without having to lift the entire set of data into your, you know, mm-hmm. RAM or whatever and have to work with it. And also the lazy execution lets it work across larger amounts, you know, kind of after the fact, which is kind of nice too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been impressed with it. You sound like you've worked with PySpark quite a bit. Have you used other things? Like I have a background of using R, and I felt Polars kind of was a little more like R's tidyverse kind of, mm-hmm. the way it's written as far as chaining things and or piping, as you called it.
Mm-hmm. Piping is good, chaining. Yeah, either way works.
Yeah, they're similar. Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
But it's nice that it's also not a lot of setup to use Polars, you know? Like,
yeah.
You can leverage Polars without the pain of setting up like PySpark.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. No, that's a whole other lift, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that some people switching from Pandas to Polars mm-hmm. have had a complaint that it no longer has an index and they're accustomed to using it or using indexing as a technique inside of it. Have you noticed that, or have you noticed any other things that have kept people potentially away from switching?
Yeah, I haven't heard of that one, but I think the one that I heard of is just the fact that Polar's syntax is very different from Pandas. And for okay. companies that
having to learn the new syntax, yeah.
Learn new syntax, and also like they need to do a lot of migration let's say they have a large code base, then they need to rewrite quite a bit of them in order to use Polars. And so I think the complaint was just to like the migration and the syntax learning curve.
Yeah, yeah. Makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. And also you need to onboard your teammates, right? Like, yeah, you prefer Polars, but your teammates prefer to stick with Pandas, then
yeah.
you cannot just switch everything to Polars. I think it's yeah. easier for the new project, but also, another thing about Polars is it's not like it's relatively new framework. So it's not every new other framework, like other frameworks might not support it.
Right.
So you want to find something that supports it. I do think that there's a lot of movement towards like supporting polars. And it's getting very easy now. If you have a Python library that support pandas, it becomes very easy now to also support polars. There's a package called NaWales.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I have the person who created that write one of the blog for us. It's like a guest blog.
Oh, that's great. Marco Gorelli, right?
Yes. And he, it was great.
Yeah. Yeah. He's great. He came on the show, I don't know, a year and a half ago. It's been a while, but yeah, he's still pounding away at that project, and it's great to see that somebody working on.
Yeah, he's very passionate about.
Yeah, interoperability.
Yeah,
not only of the data frame libraries, but all the other pieces of data science that kind of go with it. The you know the things that that I'm excited about of like doing data visualizations or doing other kinds of ways of manipulating data inside there. So it's nice to see that we're continuing. That's cool. I'll have to check out the article that he wrote with you.
Yeah.
Going back to notebooks, one of the things that you are championing that I've also been a big fan of this year is Marimo.
Mm-hmm.
I guess, how is that going? And what are some of the advantages that you see of people switching from Jupyter to using Marimo notebooks?
Yeah. So I guess like Marimo, when I saw it, when I was writing the book, Marimo, like when I started writing the book,
yeah,
Marimo hasn't come out yet, but I kind of left the chapter of Jupyter Notebooks at the end because this is the thing, like I am not a big fan of Jupyter Notebooks, but I know that a lot of my readers are using Jupyter Notebooks.
Yeah.
So the solution shouldn't be like, hey, don't use notebook, right? I want to find a common ground. And some of the issues I identify with the notebooks are the fact that if you run it differently in different orders, then it can, and it's so common, right? And it can produce different outputs. That's one thing.
Yeah.
And like you can do trick of that. Like you can try to, I don't know, like every time you run all cells, right? Then, but it's like a lot of work, take a lot of time, a lot of computation.
Yes.
And also other things I don't remember. But Marimo is solved that exact problems, right? And oh, also another thing, Jupyter Notebook is a JSON based. And it's like,
yes.
Oh, Marimo, it allows you to write it as a notebook, but then at the same time, it's a .py file. Like, that is amazing. It's like you have the best of both worlds, the interactivity, and you have a Python script. And if it is a Python script under the hood, then you can do whatever you want with it. Just like a Python script, you can do unit testing very easily. You can just import it, the functions or whatever from that notebook, right? Like the .py notebook.
Yeah, exactly.
Good practice. Also, like another thing I really like Marimo, like if you change, you know, like in notebook, if you change something in one cell, you need to remember like which one depend on that one so that, of course you can run everything, but you probably don't want to run everything if your notebook is very heavy. So you run the dependent cells, and to do it manually is very difficult.
Right.
To remember that. But with Marimo, it automatically run the dependent cells. I also like the fact that it's like keep track of which variable, like the dependencies between cells. And oh, another thing is it integrated very well with UV, right? So like if you have UV and you have Marimo, it's like very nice.
Yeah.
Because one problem with notebook is you would like pip install something, right? I see people do that like in the notebook, like pip install something.
Yeah. And they might even do it like deeper into the notebook, like in cell 25 or something like that, you know?
And they don't really specify the version of the package, right? Or like there's no, what I try to say is says, like, let's say you pip install pandas and then later, I don't know, 1 year later, maybe you run that again. With pip install pandas, but it will be a different pandas version, right? If it's installed from scratch. So there's a dependencies issues there with a notebook. But with Marimo, what happened is you don't even do pip install. So let's say you import something, like you import plotly, right? And then it will like detect it and you say, oh, hey, you're missing plotly dependencies, like you want to install it. And then when you install it, it is trapped. So
okay,
what happens is the next time it's trapped in like the top of the notebook, which is a .py file. So the next time you can do it, it used with UV. So UV, I don't remember the exact command, but like UV run something, something. But like it reproduced exactly because, you know, if the code stays the same, if the dependencies are exactly the same, you will have the same output.
As you've shared these techniques with other people, what has been the reaction of it? Like, what have people thought of, you know, when you do a lot of writing, you get a lot of comments on your mm-hmm. site, and maybe even back with your other data science comrades or colleagues,
yeah.
What would they say about Marimo and the changes there?
I think they like it. It does take some time. Like when I told them about the features, like, oh, this is amazing. I want to try it, right? What surprised me though is it seems like it takes some learning curve for them. So there's some restrictions in Marimo. For example, variable. It doesn't allow you to repeat the same variable name.
Gives you like a warning, right, as you type it out.
It's not even a warning. You cannot do it. It's an error.
Yeah, okay.
So for example, data frame. You do like data frame equals something, something, right?
Right.
And then later you like data frame equals something, something. It will raise an error. And if you think about it, it makes sense because if you want it to be, first of all, it tracks dependencies by the name. So it cannot repeat. But at the same time, you also think of like, if it's all in a Python script, then like, you know, it's bad practices for you to
right.
You reuse the same variable names for different things. And I do think that restriction is good, but I also think that it's like kind of, you know, make it, because a lot of time I feel like data scientists use their notebook like a scratch pad, like they just put one of a code.
Yes.
So it's like a new, to them, it's like, oh, there's more restrictions in the notebook, right?
Yeah. It's this whole paradigm shift where they have to like really think differently. Like this is going to happen now where it's going to lead you toward not making an unreproducible notebook, but that requires you to recognize like, oh, these are things that I was doing. It's kind of weird, like these library enforced, it's trying to break your practices, almost like stopping you from smoking or something like that. You know, yeah. Like it's going to just keep giving you these little, like kind of push you in this direction of better practices, which I think is great, but yeah, it's going to be hard for a certain subset of people who've used to like, I just want to use it like a notebook.
Yeah. I don't think Marimo is a replacement of Jupyter Notebook. I think
yeah.
if you want, like Jupyter Notebook is still good for prototyping. And if you like, you just like want to throw away afterwards.
Right.
And it's like, because a lot of time, right, like you create like a quick notebook for like some proof of concept and you don't really ever touch it again. And that's fine. But if you think about using notebook for production,
yes,
then there need to be some restrictions on how you code.
Yeah, yeah. And it's definitely going to enforce them.
Yeah.
Which I think is good. Yeah, it's different. If you were back in that position you had before and you were working with your ML engineer and you provided them with Marimo notebooks, would they, you think they'd be happy with that as far as the reproducibility?
Yes. I still think that Marimo is a tool.
Yeah.
And it still need a require you. Like, it's not like it will automatically make it reproducible if people use a Marimo notebook.
Right.
I think it helps you a lot, but at the same time, it still require like good practices, like, you know, writing code that is clean and readable.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's time to shine a spotlight on another Real Python video course. And it touches on one of the tools we discussed this week. The course is titled Python Project Management with UV. It's based on a Real Python tutorial by Leodonis Pozo Ramos, And the video course is presented by Rodrigo Jirao Serrao. And in the course, you'll learn how to use UV as a Python package and project manager, how it integrates multiple functions into one tool. You'll practice using UV for fast dependency installation. You'll also learn how UV automatically handles virtual environments, creating and managing them as needed to ensure clean, isolated project dependencies. It also can manage which version of Python your project's using. You also learn how to use it to initialize a project and how to continue the process using UV to build and publish Python packages to a package repository like PyPI. Like most of the video courses on Real Python, the course is broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, you get code examples for the technique shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can also find it using the search tool on realpython.com. In the book, we've talked a little bit about providing other team members inside of a data science organization, going from a scientist to, like, say, an engineer or somebody else. And I think you kind of addressed this a little bit early on. You use the word shipping, and to me, that can mean a lot of different things. I guess, what are the different ways? Who is the consumer or user you're referring to there? Maybe in the case of your book, like, who are we shipping to?
Okay, can you give me the entire sentence?
You mentioned, like, shipping an ML pipeline.
Okay. It's like, when I think about the context of the book, it's like data scientists try to give it to their teammate, which is like data engineer or ML engineer. That's what I mean by shipping.
Okay.
So it's not necessary that they will deploy the model themselves, but it's like hand it off to someone else.
Okay. So they can reproduce it and be able to use it.
Yes. I guess it's twofold. I try to think of, so I was thinking about the CI pipeline.
Okay.
Continuous integration. So something that, like, a scenario is, let's say there's already a machine learning model in production, and you as a data scientist, you have created a model with better performance, then how do you put it into production? Let's say, for the simplicity's sake, the model in production is in the main branch, right? Like, all the code and all the versioning. Like, let's say your model lives somewhere else, or your data lives somewhere else, but all the versioning are in the main branch of the GitHub repository. Then if you set it up so that if it's being merged into the main branch, then it will be into production. Then how do you have all the checks necessary before it is merged into the main branch?
Okay.
So the CI pipeline is one of the solutions, right? So you, first of all, it's good practices that come with version control, right?
Yes.
You need to do it in, like, a different branch, and then you create a pull request. When you create a pull request, then if you set up a CI pipeline, which is continuous integration, then it can run automatic tests. So it can test and make sure, let's say it can run your unit tests, right? Making sure that they pass, creating a report, and also that will pull your data from other resources and check to make sure that the performance of the new one is better. So you can, like, set up some tests as a safeguard against merging your, because a lot of time that you test it locally, it might not, you know, like, it's not reliable, right? You want to have, like, a automated test that, like, safeguard before it merges into production. I guess that could be considered as shipping an ML pipeline.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. So that's a big part of the book then, is you get into, I feel that isn't a practice as much at the data scientist levels of using GitHub. This is just anecdotal data from my own use around people. Mm-hmm. But, and also, I worked at a couple different institutions, banks, and other places where we had our own, like, Git system, you know, for checking stuff in. And of course, unless we built like a CI, CD kind of pipeline inside of our own organization, we didn't have the advantages of something like GitHub as a tool. Is that something that you're explaining or kind of teaching practices within the book?
I teach Git specifically, but not really necessarily go into like, you know, because the platform, it can be like GitHub or any other tracking version control system, but Git is what I'm focusing on.
Okay.
Also, I try to go more into like use cases, meaning that let's say, what do you do when, you know, you start a new repository, right? Or like a new project. What do you do when, let's say, you mess it up? You are doing something, you like experiment with something, and then you mess it up. Like, how do you go back, right? How do you revert it? So
yeah.
The good practices here is, first of all, you need to commit a lot. Like, just every milestone you make. I feel like a lot of times data scientists, they make like a big commit, you know, like they're using version control, but like every time yeah. they commit, it's like a big commit, or they don't do pull requests often enough. And then when it's merged, it's like a bunch of merge conflicts to merge, especially when their coworkers also work on, you know, the same kind of the same file, but like their own variations. So it's good for them to commit small and commit often, so that when incidents happen, they can revert. So the book talk about those cases and other common cases when it comes to like what you do when incidents happen in a data science project, basically, with Git.
That's cool. Yeah, I think that's really vital stuff. It makes me think of video games a little bit, in the sense that if you play like a role-playing game, there are people that will not save often and that are truly frustrated when suddenly something bad happens and they have to go back, you know, 2 hours, 3 hours or whatever.
Yeah.
As opposed to somebody who's like saving often, right, and can go back and just fix something small. But it's kind of getting in the practice of it. So I guess that seems to be a repeating theme of like building practices and getting used to doing these types of things. Mm-hmm. I think that takes me to the idea of testing, which is, again, also a thing that's hard for, I think, data scientists sometimes to wrap their heads around. Mm-hmm. I feel like that concept is a little foreign, and maybe they don't know where to start. And I don't know if you have suggestions on where people, especially in, say, a notebook type of environment, where a data scientist might start with testing.
Yeah, definitely. So I think first you move some of the reusable code to a Python script, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it's also come with writing Python functions too. Have an easier time writing tests, you want to write Python functions that are small, doing one thing,
okay,
like have one single responsibility, and also ideally don't have global variables, because that means like external dependencies, because that means that you need to incorporate that into your unit test. And when it comes to unit tests, I do think that you can skip, like, you don't really need to do unit tests for all the functions, right? Unit tests should be to test the functionality of your function to ensure that it works with a variety of cases.
Okay.
So I want to give an example. Like, a lot of times, data scientists, like, why should I test, right? Because, for example, in a notebook, I run A and I expect B, and then I saw B. Like, that's good enough. Like, why testing?
Right. Test complete, I'm done.
Yeah. So there's twofold to that. First is, you know, to rely on your like judgment is erroneous. Like, it's not reliable, because let's say you expect a 0001 and you saw a 0011, and like if you just scan it, you're like, oh, it looks good, but it's not right.
Right.
So the fact that you actually writing it down, if I put A in, I will see B. And the fact that you write it down, it make it like more reliable. That's one thing. Another thing is if you just test with one case, how do you make? So the thing is, it's not just prototyping, right? You want this code to go into production. So you want it to work with a variety of cases.
Right.
And also another thing is you want to reuse this function for different things. So you want to ensure it works with a variety of cases. So you can unit test. And with unit tests, you can, for example, you was wondering like, so if I put A in, I get B, but if I put C, do I have D? Or so like it allows you to test different hypotheses in, if you just do all those in notebook, it's very messy. And, but like with unit tests is, you know, you have a function here and you have unit tests here and you run with a variety of cases. So it's very clean. At the same time, unit tests can serve very well as a documentation for your function because sometimes people look at your function and they're like, what is this doing? Right? Because you see, I mean, of course, you should write readable function, but even if you write readable function, it's still hard for people, like if it's a complicated function, it's still hard for people to understand it. So if they see how it is done, let's say with unit tests, a lot of time you like provide an example, like a variety of example. So you put some like, for example, a multiply function. So if you see the input is 1, 2, 3 and the output is multiply input, comma 3, then, and you see it's like 3, 6, 9. So you understand, you don't need to like read through the function. You can just read the unit test.
Right.
To understand what the function does. And
you can look at the ins, you can look at the outs, you can see the results. Yeah, yeah. I like the writing it down thing. That's interesting because it's like a thing that so often is taught to learn anything. You know, like one of the common things you have is just like, okay, I want to learn this concept. It requires this extra step of you pausing, taking and using this different part of your brain. And I feel like testing is that. Mm-hmm. It's like shifting programming into this other gear, potentially making you think about how you would explain this. Think about, well, what are the test cases? What are the different types of ways I personally might reuse this code because we're trying to make it reusable and trying mm-hmm. to make it more functional. So yeah, I like that idea of like, okay, it pauses you for a minute to think about how all this stuff works. Often, I feel like people create, well, definitely with AI, people create tests that are very, very nonsensical in the sense that they're just like, not only A, B, they'll make it just be Boolean. It's like, true, okay, we're good, then we're tested. And it's like, no, like that's not really testing, you know, thoroughly of like what the function's doing. And
yeah,
and I agree with the documentation part. So
yeah. I heard a episode somewhere on like a founder of TDD, test driven development, and he also works with AI now, right? But what he does is he writes a test himself, and then like asks it to write functions to test again the unit test. But like the fact that you write the functions yourself to like, you know, specify the behaviors, right, to make sure that it's matching behaviors that you expected.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's great to see. It's hard for people to get over the hump though, like of like having to do the step of it. It's, you know, almost like the parse process of learning again, of having to write things down.
Yeah, I that is true. I do think that you don't need to start like do everything, right? Just do for the most important thing and then just do that first and expand it as necessary. It does. And I think to be able to, people wouldn't do things that they don't think necessary, you know, so be able to understand the benefit of it too is like, for example, people just tell you, hey, you should do unit tests. You're like, why? Why should I do it? You just get lazy, you know, but if you know the benefit of it, you know what it's for, then maybe you can focus on creating the tests that actually matter.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like the test-driven development thing is hard for an experimenter, person who's trying out these kinds of things. And I don't know if somebody necessarily needs to learn that entire paradigm to start.
No.
And in fact, you talk about unit test almost exclusively so far. Mm-hmm. Are you using other tools? Or are you using things like PyTest or other tools?
Yeah, I use PyTest.
Okay.
I really like PyTest because it's very easy to use compared to unit tests. It's, and I find that the code, the test also more readable as well with PyTest.
Yeah, yeah. You've mentioned a little bit about this sort of modularity of notebooks, potentially, you know, keeping some of the functionality reusable. Are there other areas where you think that you should consider, you know, separating parts of your code?
Yeah, so I think values is another thing. So I'll give a scenario. Let's say you want to experiment, and I'm thinking about like maybe like a machine learning experiments, right?
Okay.
Or like just data processing functions. You want to try with different parameters. And if you are working with a Python script, this will apply to notebook too, but the ability to... So let's say you want to change something for the sake of experiments. You would need to like dive into the code to like see where it is at. And if you repeat that value multiple places, you need to change it in multiple places. And first of all, that is time-consuming. That's discourage people from experiments. Another thing is you can make error because, you know, let's say you change here, but you forgot to change there, then there will be some errors.
Yeah.
So what if you can just like extract those, put in a different files, and those files will only contain the information about the parameters, like which values you can use, which is like a YAML file, right? And you can just go in and you can change.
Yeah, yeah.
Then that's, to me, that's like very powerful. You can separate it. That will make it so much easier for people to change your values, and also it keep your code less messy, it's more readable, and also it's make your code more documented too. So instead of saying, I don't know, some processing function you multiply by 120, like people read your code and say, what is he or she or whoever, like why 120 here, right?
Yeah.
But if with the configuration, you can say config dog processing dog, some readable name, then like the person can like understand what it is about. So it's also like more readable as well.
Right. I think it's interesting because you see that pattern across so many areas of computing. Like the fact that you have a settings file for, you know, almost every program you can think of, and it's stored in a similar way. And that might be, you know, preferences about like how I'm left-handed, so I you know, run things this way or whatever. To be able to migrate that into your code to see the advantage of how different users might use this, or you might put on a different hat that today we're going to use this code to do this other thing by having a list of variables and not... I don't have a computer science background, so I sometimes throw these terms out. I don't know if I always get them right, but I hear this term magic number used, which is like to hard code an actual value into your code. And then you, again, you see this 120 somewhere in your code. And you're like, what is that? And what does that equal? And as opposed to having it set aside in the configuration file where it's named as a variable, and then that variable's used across the rest of it, and you're importing all that stuff in. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that's great. That's a really good practice.
Yeah. And also with unit testing as well, like you don't need to depend on that variable, you know, like you can switch because like if it's not hard coded, it's not in the code, then you can like test with different values as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Like it opens up so many possibilities without necessarily breaking your code. One of the things that you mentioned also that I think is interesting that we didn't harp on too much, but when you do like a git commit and you some, you know, people often will run the idea of a diff, you know, like see the differences between things, and this ability to not change your code so much. Marimo is yet another win there in the sense that it is a Python file. When you change a Jupyter notebook, I don't know if you've seen this yourself, but the diffs are pretty crazy because it's all JSON and everything sort of shifts around and it's not very readable to see what has been changed. Just kind of going back to that idea.
Yeah, even with the tool for like notebook diff, which is much better, it's still not as good.
Oh, okay. I didn't know about that.
It's still not as good as, because if you think about it, it's have the output and the cell. It's like so many things for you to compare. Like if the output is different, it says it's different, but it shouldn't be the case. It's what you compare is the code. You are virtually control the code, not the output, you know?
Yes. Yeah. Not the outputting and formatting or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's great. I like to ask everybody who comes on the show some questions. And the first one is, what are you excited about in the world of Python?
I am excited about, I feel like there's a lot of modern tools coming out and I like to see more of like UV. I like what to see of more of Ruff.
Yeah.
I like to see more of Merimo. And I think there's a lot of movement towards modernize the tools that we are using and the fact that they are also being open source.
Yeah. My thing to add on top of that is that almost everything you mentioned there, I'm trying to think of the name of the company that does Ruff and UV, Astral.
Astral,
All Astral stuff is all Rust based, and so it's very fast.
Oh yeah, Rust is very nice. Yeah.
Yeah. What's something that you want to learn next? This doesn't have to be about programming; could be, you know, any creative pursuit you're interested in.
I think I like to understand more of like applications of LLM in data science. I have been writing more pieces about that, but I kind of want to like dive deeper into it.
Okay.
In the future.
Are there particular tools that interest you right now?
LangChain, LangIndex, LangGraph is
okay.
What I have been writing about. I guess it's like a lot of things to dig into.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm pretty excited about how easy it is to use them for different applications.
Yeah, cool. Well, that leads me to the next question. Well, will people watch your experiments and follow along with it? What's the best way to follow your work?
They can just go to codecut.ai. I also, another thing that I like to do is to send out newsletter 3 times per week. And each newsletter, it have like a lot of like different code snippets.
Okay.
And that's my ways of teaching something I try to extract. Because, again, I assume my audience are very busy, so I want them to be able to consume as much as possible in the minimal amount of time. So they can go to my website, they can see my blogs, but they can also get code snippets that are like featuring different functionalities of different tools in one code snippet that can be consumed in 2 minutes.
Nice. That sounds like a great way to... I don't know. There's so much stuff that comes in your email today. It's nice to have something that's a bit of a gift there. Yeah, cool. Are you doing anything on the social media front?
Yes. I have LinkedIn and X/Twitter. I have around, I think, 115,000 followers on LinkedIn. So that's kind of like my effort.
Yeah.
I post like basically every day except for the week. So people can follow me on LinkedIn as well, which they will find the link at the end of my website. I don't want to like give people too much, but they can just go to codecut.ai and they will find everything there.
All right. Well, Quinn, it's been really fantastic to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's very fun.
I want to thank Quinn for coming on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening to the Real Python Podcast. Make sure that you click that follow button in your podcast player. And if you see a subscribe button somewhere, remember that the Real Python Podcast is free. If you like the show, please leave us a review. You can find show notes with links to all the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.